From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast.
Hello, welcome to the China in the World podcast. This is Tong Zhao. Today, we are happy to have Dr. Richard Weitz from Hudson Institute with us to discuss how US, China, and Russia can cooperate to mitigate nuclear threats. As we all know, the trilateral relationship is at an interesting juncture. Previously, China worked with the United States during the Cold War to contain the Soviet influence. But today, the US-China strategic competition, strategic rivalry is growing very quickly. Kissinger even suggested that US should develop a closer relationship with Russia to contain the growing Chinese influence. But on the ground, we see China and Russia quickly developing a very close defense and security cooperation relationship. So it's the triangular relationship is in flux. Nuclear is a very important component of this triangular relationship. On that front, we also see a lot of interesting developments. Russia has revealed a number of interesting new nuclear weapon systems. A global range nuclear-powered nuclear cruise missile, intercontinental range self-navigating nuclear torpedo, and maybe even nuclear-armed hypersonic weapons. To counter this increasing threat, in the most recent Nuclear Posture Review report, the United States re-emphasized the importance of low-yield tactical nuclear weapons to counter the so-called Russian strategy of escalate to de-escalate. And seeing all this, I'm sure there will be a lot of debate in China about how China should respond. Maybe China should follow suit to pursue some similar capabilities. So the nuclear relationship is at a very unstable phase. Not only will increase risks at the nuclear level, but also could have important spillover effect to, for example, conventional military relationship. It will affect their capability to cooperate to address important regional nuclear non-proliferation threats, or their capability to cooperate against nuclear terrorism. To discuss these issues, we have, again, Richard Weitz, who is Senior Fellow and a Director of the Center for Political Military Analysis at Hudson Institute. And his research includes regional security developments relating to Europe, Eurasia, and East Asia, as well as American foreign and defense policies. So welcome, Richard.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
So maybe I will start by asking you an initial question. Maybe you can briefly explain to us, based on your recent research on this topic, what are the major risks and opportunities for cooperation among these three countries in the area of nuclear arms control?
Right. So I look at the field in terms of three areas. The first area is limiting, reducing, or measured increases in the nuclear arsenals of the existing countries. And here, Russia, the U.S., and China are very important because Russia and the U.S. have the largest arsenals. China has a lot of potential to increase its nuclear arsenal. But I'm not very optimistic in this. I think there's just some fundamental disagreements between the countries about where to go next. The second area, as opposed to limiting existing arsenals, is to keep other countries who don't have nuclear weapons from getting them, the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And that area, I'm more optimistic, and particularly because of developments in Korea, I'm much more optimistic than I was last year in terms of the possibilities to make progress in limiting and hopefully eliminating the North Korean nuclear arsenal. And that requires strong Russian, Chinese, U.S. cooperation to succeed. And then Iran is another potential country that could pursue nuclear weapons. And even as the U.S. withdraws from the previous agreement limiting Iran's nuclear activities, it's still going to work with Russia and China to keep Iranian nuclear activities limited, perhaps even missile activity. And beyond that, I'm pretty optimistic that none of these three countries want other countries to pursue nuclear weapons. And then the last area, the first being limiting existing arsenals, the second being preventing new countries, the third is keeping these nuclear materials and nuclear weapons away from non-state actors, particularly terrorists, but also criminals. There, it's different in that all the countries pretty much agree on the importance of doing this. There's not any country favoring nuclear terrorism and so on. But there's a concern that there may not be enough attention, enough resources to address this issue, since it's a very low likelihood, but very, very, very high consequence issue. So those issues are hard for governments to manage in general.
Thank you. Great. I think maybe we should go into one important external variable that will affect these countries' capability to do arms control and to maintain their existing strategic stability relationship among themselves, and that is missile defense. Especially, I think this upcoming U.S. missile defense posture review report is likely to call for a policy of more investment into development and deployment of missile defense, including in this region of Northeast Asia. That is going to cause a lot of concern in China about the credibility of Chinese nuclear deterrent capability. I know you have focused a lot on the Russian-U.S. experience of engagement and dialogues to address the Russian concern of U.S. missile defense. Those dialogues, exchanges took place at various levels for a very long time. Many different proposals were raised, including, you know, the data fusion center, technical information exchanges, better transparency on future plans on missile defense, etc. So my question is, how would you evaluate the impact of these engagement on mitigating Russian concern? Any lessons that you can draw from the U.S.-Russian engagement experience to the U.S.-China engagement on this issue? Because I believe if we want to stabilize U.S.-China nuclear relation in the future, we have to address this rising Chinese concern about U.S. missile defense.
Right. So just to reaffirm what you said, that the U.S. is now soon to release a report of all new administrations. It's now the Trump's administration's preparing this one on what its policy should be towards missile defense. And the thinking is that the administration may differ from previous ones. In the past, it was always a statement that U.S. missile defenses are not designed or capable of, you know, hitting Russian or Chinese missiles. They're really designed for Iran and North Korea. And the thinking is now it may be somewhat more restrained, saying there's not an intent to interfere with Russia's or China's strategic missiles, but shorter range systems may be acceptable. And the U.S., Russia and China all have missile defense programs. I mean, China has the ground, you know, sort of a ground mid-course system. that some Americans think maybe also have an anti-satellite function. Russia has had the longest missile defense system, although its effectiveness is not well understood. It's limited mostly to Moscow. And the U.S. has had a lot of variables going up and down, how much it's willing to put into this. It probably isn't going to be a priority of the Trump administration. The objective of is, I mean, the ideal would be to have a missile defense that's effective at preventing North Korea or another country from being able to threaten the United States or its allies with missile defense, but not so effective that it causes China and or Russia to reinforce even more so its offensive forces in an effort to overcome them. The U.S. and Russia tried for several years through various talks, confidence-building measures. Even at one point, a proposal for a joint system that they would jointly operate over the Northern Hemisphere. And none of those proved successful. It's just so difficult because in order to shoot down a missile, you have to make an instant decision, and therefore you can't allow wait for the other country's approval. If you share insights about how your missile defense system works, there's a fear that then that information would find its way towards the country that wants to use a missile against you and so could overcome it, and just a series of problems. And that was not seen as helpful. So I think it's best to try and think about what would be a level that the three countries would feel comfortable, would help them defend them from possible nuclear missile attacks, but wouldn't be stabilizing to the other. And China is the hardest one to deal with, since its offensive nuclear forces are less than those of Russia and China, and therefore the threshold is a bit lower. So far, the Chinese, like the Russians, have relied on having effective offensive forces. China's developing now submarines and perhaps even bomber force they could over to do this. And so we've all pursued the same policy, diversifying our nuclear offensive forces to overcome any missile defenses. But it's going to be a challenge to manage forward. I think that in the short term, the thing we can best do to mitigate, to keep these tensions limited, is to focus on preventing North Korea from testing its missiles or nuclear weapons, because that's really the main driver at the moment on the U.S. defensive program, which is causing the anxieties in Russia and China.
Great. I think another threat to a stable nuclear relationship among the big powers comes from new military technologies. All three countries are developing hypersonic weapons that can be armed with conventional nuclear warheads. Some country, especially Russia, is developing a global range nuclear-powered nuclear cruise missile and intercontinental range nuclear torpedo, etc. How do you think we can realistically incorporate these new strategic weapon systems into some arms control mechanism in order to mitigate their potential impact on nuclear stability? If some formal treaty is unlikely, how about some possible confidence building measures?
Right. The best work on this question has actually been done by Carnegie experts, James Acton and others. It's something we do need to address now, because these technologies are like the missile defenses are now becoming available to all three of our countries, and all three have hypersonic delivery system programs, somewhat different types, but still the same technology. Yet, we haven't deployed these systems, so if you're going to have arms control, the best time to do it is before you start building them, because once you start, it's harder to look for constraints. But because of the differences between the countries on a range of issues, it would be hard to have an agreement that would just focus on one of these technologies. So, in principle, it would be ideal, and it would certainly be easier to address hypersonic systems than strategic defenses, or let alone strategic offenses, because it's new. But the arrangement would probably focus more on transparency, making sure that each side had an understanding of what these systems could do, so they don't trigger some kind of surprise or launch on warning or any kind of destabilizing crisis policies, and in particular limiting the spread of this technology to other countries. So it would be something like the missile technology control regime, but China would have a lead role in constructing the regime because of it. It's this different status now than in before. But if we, I think that if we keep the technology limited to Russia, China, and the United States, that's a challenge, but it's a lot easier than if, you know, everybody had this, North Korea, Pakistan, whatever, because then it really is a concern. The problem with hypersonic systems is, since it's not necessarily a ballistic path, that makes it easier for them to overcome missile defenses, but it also makes it a little uncertain about if you're attacked with one of these, you don't quite, maybe not understand, is it a nuclear armed or conventional armed system? What it might be able to do in some scenarios, some crises. So it's a bit of unknown, like cyber, like anti-satellite weapons. It may have an enhanced deterrence because of the uncertainty, but certainly in a crisis, it prevents problems, challenges for crisis management, limiting escalation.
Okay, as you said, it's best to look at one of these systems. So maybe let's look more into the hypersonic weapons for a moment. Any prospect for cooperative restraint on the development and deployment of hypersonic weapons, for example, renouncing the option of arming them with nuclear warheads? Or at least, do you think there would be interest among these big powers to cooperate to prevent the further proliferation of hypersonic weapon technologies to more countries?
Right. I'm not aware of any active effort of the three countries to limit their own systems. The Trump administration is still undergoing its review about what it wants in New START or other types. So it may decide that it wants to try and achieve a different type of arms control agreement, and that should include hypersonic systems. The Russian government has actually been leading the effort to try and include these systems, but I'm not aware of a concrete proposal to limit it. And in fact, one of the systems that Putin announced, or maybe actually several, are hypersonic delivery systems. And China's program is, I mean, it's interesting because this is an area where China is equal to the other countries. It's not a lagging, unlike some of the other systems. But I'm not aware of a concrete proposal or the form we would do this. But that said, if you're trying to think of an area where we could initiate some kind of trilateral arms control, this would be the perfect, or, you know, the best system among those currently available, because our countries are leading developers of hypersonic systems, and we would all suffer if other countries were to get them. So it would be, if we can't prevent them or, you know, agree on what they can carry or where they could be located, I think we should be able to agree on the importance of not transferring this technology to other countries. I think, you know, it's a little tricky for Russia because of their collaboration with India on the BrahMos missile. It's a shorter range system, but there is a hypersonic variant that they've been discussing develop. So we might have to grandfather that. But beyond that, I don't see any need for other countries to have them. And it is a destabilizing system, so we do have an incentive to limit the cooperation, limit the proliferation through cooperation.
in the area of nuclear nonproliferation, a lot of things are happening with regard to North Korea. So far, people's attention has been on US, the two Koreas, China, etc. We haven't discussed the role of Russia very extensively. Very recently, the South Korean President Moon Jae-in said Kim is likely to meet with the Russian president very soon. So maybe the Russian role will become more visible in the near-term future. What do you think Russia wants to achieve in this process of negotiation about North Korea's nuclear program? How high a priority do you think Russia attaches to a quick disarmament of North Korea?
Right. President Putin has always been interested in the North Korean issue. I mean, one of the first things he did after becoming president was to go to Pyongyang and offer the North Koreans access to the Russian civilian space program. At the time, the North Koreans were insisting on their right to test these, what they called space vehicles. But, you know, they're kind of, it's hard to differentiate between a space system and an offensive missile capacity. And that didn't work. There was, you know, but he's since been particularly interested in working on that issue. In the last few years, Russia's lead role in trying to deal with Kim Jong-un has been somewhat displaced. I mean, we've now seen both the U.S. president and the Chinese leader meet with Supreme Leader Kim. And, President Putin, I think that meeting will occur. I think that we'll now have a meeting between President Putin and Chairman Kim at some point, not clear when, not clear where. But moving to the next phase when we move from these bilateral meetings to the multilateral level, it would be best to have Russia involved in some way. It's not as critical as China and the U.S. and the two Koreas, but Russia, the farther out we look, the better opportunities there are for have a positive Russian contribution. So if we can solve, quote unquote, the North Korean crisis in terms of integrating North Korea into East Asia better, binding it through international constraints, Russia has had the most developed plans for using a North Korean participation as a means to enhance their own integration into East Asia through pipelines, through railroads that would traverse the peninsula. According to U.S. diplomats, Russia and U.S. cooperation on North Korea continues. It's one of the areas where the interests are strongest, and despite short-term differences over sanctions, over pacing, how quickly North Korea has to denuclearize, to how quickly we have to we should remove the sanctions, I think those differences are manageable. So I think that this is a fruitful area for Russia, U.S., Chinese cooperation going forward, as long as we can shield it from some of the other tensions which are affecting other issues.
But one difference between Russian and American perceptions about the North Korean threat is Russia claimed, right, that last year when North Korea conducted an ICBM test, intercontinental ballistic missile test, everyone said it was an ICBM test, but Russia insisted it was a much shorter range missile, probably an intermediate range ballistic missile. Do you think Russia held a genuinely different view on North Korean capability? If so, is it useful apply the same experience of the Russian-U.S. joint threat assessment on Iranian missile threat to the North Korean case to help bridge their gap?
Right. I know that after the first North Korean ICBM test, as you said, the Russians differed from most assessments saying it really wasn't an ICBM. But I didn't see that after the subsequent test. I think that the Russian view has moved closer to that of Chinese and U.S. experts. In general, Russia has downplayed the North Korean threat. There's always been a lower threat assessment from the Russian side, either that North Korea's technology is not as advanced as feared, or its pace of development is slower, trying to dampen the incentives, for preemptive confrontation with the U.S., weaken the legitimacy of sanctions, and so on. So that's been a lagging problem, and for that reason, the Iran, U.S., and other joint threat assessments conducted through NATO and any with Russia, they didn't really help resolve the differences. They just made them clearer. So it gave them an opportunity to understand better their differences, but it didn't narrow them. I think we can best circumvent this problem rather than try and solve it by focusing on something that is easy to measure, which is not, North Korea is not testing any missiles even approaching this range, not testing nuclear weapons. And then we don't have to fight over, is this an ICBM? Is this not an ICBM? Is this a hydrogen bomb? Or is it just an enhanced atomic bomb, tritium enhanced? Or so those that if we just don't test at all, then this problem doesn't arise. And so that's what I would focus on. In general, the Russians are, their concerns about North Korea are not that North Korea will attack Russia. It's more North Korea is testing systems and that are driving U.S. missile defenses, which in turn then are a challenge for Russia. Or risk of an escalation, a war on Russia's backyard in the neighborhood, and so on. But all these can be circumvented just by getting as quickly as possible to a non-nuclear North Korea, but at least in the interim, not having further tests.
Let me follow up with a more big picture question. Today, many people are worried that U.S.-China relationship might escalate into something like a new Cold War. So it seems to me that a big problem today is the two countries, US and China, are incapable of reaching basic agreement on what happened as facts. Right. In one example in the area of weapons of mass destruction is the reported use of chemical weapons in Syria. Vast majority of Chinese experts, I'm talking about not just the general public, but highly educated, very experienced experts in this area, they firmly believe that it was not the Syrian government that used chemical weapons, but it was a campaign of demonization by the West, led by the United States, to counter Russia. So if we cannot even agree on the basic facts, how can we talk about cooperation? How can we talk about, the two sides cannot even talk meaningfully with each other on these basic issues. So that deeply concerns me. Given that you have been studying US-Russia, US-Soviet relationship for a long time, US-Soviet Union was there. But now US-China faces a threat of launching a new Cold War. Any lessons that you can draw from the US-Soviet experience to help US-China from further escalating their tensions and their rivalry?
Right. I actually reject the idea that China and the U.S. are on in the same situation or are on the path towards a new Cold War, like we saw between the Soviet Union and the United States. I mean, I'm a child of the Cold War. I grew up in the Cold War. That's why I got interested in this issue and tried to learn Russian. If I were younger now, maybe I'd do Chinese instead. But anyway, it was because I there was genuinely days where I thought the end of the world would soon be upon us. I don't see that now. There are some fundamental differences between what we saw then with the Soviet bloc versus the Western bloc to what we have now. For example, China's and the U.S. Are not in a bloc-to-bloc situation. So, I mean, China, you can argue about where Russia is in this, but it's not, and the U.S. has good ties with South Korea and Japan, but there's just a lot of countries in between there that buffer some of the tensions. I mean, all the ASEAN countries are all working to avoid a major conflict. Also, the China-U.S. confrontation has not been in the military plane in the sense of it. We haven't seen the kind of confrontation we have between the Soviet Union and the United States in lining up our forces right along Europe, along Berlin, expecting them a possible military clash day to day. We haven't seen the Cuban missile type crisis with China moving a lot of its assets right up to the U.S. border to present a strategic problem in the U.S. China, in general, doesn't emphasize its military power the way the Soviets or arguably the Russians do today. I mean, and China has a rich set of tools of influence ranging from economics in particular, good diplomacy, soft power, attractiveness of Chinese culture, and so on. So it's not, it hasn't really been a military-led confrontation the way the Soviet Union, which really didn't have anything else other than its weapons, had to rely on that. So I do not see any near-term risk of a China-U.S. military clash. I do worry about an escalatory path from some kind of confrontation over Taiwan or South China Sea or so on, but it's really hard to see how that leads towards. So it's a lot less probable, in my view, than what we had with the Soviet Union and the United States. And I think that some good confidence-building measures, some restraint as we manage, quote-unquote manage, quote-unquote China's rise. So, I mean, clearly China's becoming a more influential player. It's getting more weapons, its forces, and U.S. forces are going to operate more in proximity now in the future. But I just think that the conflicts and tensions are more economic, more how to restructure the influence of both countries in a way that meets both their changing needs. But I don't really see China following the path of other rising powers and trying to carve out colonies or use its military force to displace the U.S. I still think that's very remote.
Mm. One of the specific accusations from the American side against China is China has been illegally acquiring American military technologies. I know in the Russia-China experience, for a time, Russia had a lot of headache because reportedly China reverse engineered some Russian military equipment and used that to develop its own indigenous capability and therefore became less dependent on Russian technology export. Some foreign experts even argue that the Chinese J-11 fighter jet, for example, was based on the Russian Su-27 fighter jet. So how did Russia and China resolve that problem? Maybe that can help us think more about how US and China can better address their problem, some similar problem here.
Right. The Russian perception, I mean, what happened, just as we remember, that China, the U.S. stopped selling weapons to China at the end of the Cold War. At the same time, the Soviet Union fell apart, so Russia had all these weapons it didn't need. And so it just became a natural decision that the Russians said, let's just sell all the Soviet platforms to China. And so we had $1 billion, $2 billion a year for a while of Soviet era weapons reach China. And some, as you said, some foreign experts, including some Russians, think that with several of these systems, China just took some of this technology and replicated it. And that led to a fall, for several other reasons, it led to a fall off of these sales about 7-8 years ago. There was another even more serious challenge, was that China, partly through this reverse engineering, but also through its own efforts, doesn't really need to buy Soviet-era technology. It makes its own. But that situation has ended in the sense that now Russia is again selling major weapons platforms to China, particularly the Su-35, probably one of the best fighter planes in the world, and the S-400, certainly one of the most advanced air defense systems. And there are several reasons for this, but they probably wouldn't apply in the case of Russia and the U.S. China and the U.S. So one reason was that the Russians made the strategic calculation that it was useful to help China continue to develop its military power as a way to keep the Pentagon preoccupied, or at least divided from focusing entirely on Russia. That the Russians say they are confident that they are still a generation ahead. They don't believe the Chinese claims that they have a fifth generation fighter. You talk to the Russians, they say that Russia still is a generation ahead of China in terms of these really super advanced technologies, particularly air systems, particularly missile defense systems. So they still feel comfortable selling China these systems because Russia has more advanced ones. They also say these systems are harder to copy than the Soviet-era systems. Particularly, China has had a challenge making it a really high-performance fighter engine. And they supposedly took steps to make sure that these couldn't be copied. They did sign an advanced intellectual property agreement. I don't know to what extent the Russians really believe that's effective. And then there's a final reason but it wouldn't also apply in the U.S. case, is the Russians say they think the Chinese would be able to acquire the technology for the Su-35 and S-400 anyway, so we might as well sell them to China now, get some money, rather than wait a few years in which China gets it anyhow. So none of those factors would really apply in the current case. And it's a little risk on the part of the Russian, in my view, but they deny this. They selling China this very advanced technology, I mean, I don't think China would use it against Russia directly, but it could undercut Russia's arms sales to third parties. I mean, the Chinese arms sales are increasing, the defense sector is becoming more skilled, and that those sales won't conflict with the U.S., but it could conflict with the Russians, because the same potential buyers, those that can't afford or don't have access to Western European U.S. defense technology, been buying it from Russia for the most part, but now will have China as an option. So I keep on telling the Russians, you know, be careful or you may be shooting yourselves in the foot or undermining your own competitive advantage. And they keep on, either they say, it's none of your business, I don't want to talk to you about China, it's our sensitive issue, or they just say, no, we're comfortable, we have our systems will stay ahead. So it's an interesting issue. It just doesn't really apply in the China-US case.
Well, great. Thank you, Richard, for sharing your thoughts. Apparently, nuclear is the foundation of the strategic relationship of the three big powers, but it's also the hardest to resolve their disagreements over these issues, their distrust towards each other. But I'm glad that you can come here today to help us develop a more nuanced understanding, which I think in the long run can help us start building confidence and trust step by step.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. I mean, I think that Carnegie at Tsinghua forms a great service to helping allow us to continue this dialogue in such an important bilateral relationship.
Thank you. I look forward to inviting you back sometime in the near-term future.